All right, we're going to have a nice encouraging lesson tonight on the Antichrist, because that's one of the next kind of big things that we have. And we're going to kind of go through a bunch of different scriptures. I'm going to try and go through every major scripture that mentions the Antichrist or is possibly mentioning the Antichrist. And so we'll kind of try to work through those. And then, you know, if you have questions that come up while we go through it, just we'll save it to the end and we'll see if I can tackle it. But kind of some big questions as we look at all of these passages. And these aren't, these might not be necessarily questions that you have, but these are questions that when you are coming to the Bible and you're trying to figure out what does the Bible say about the Antichrist, one of them is just that. Is the Antichrist a singular future figure? Will there be a person, a human being we are expecting who can have that title? And then there's also the beast and the prophet, because the word Antichrist is never used in the book of Revelation. But it does talk about a beast, and it does talk about a second beast. And so are those the same, or how do those kind of relate together? And then kind of the preview of my view is that there are many Antichrists, many of them throughout all of the ages, throughout all of history, and still now, who are forerunners and foreshadowing of the final Antichrist who is to come in the end. But now we can kind of look at some of the passages. One of the first main ones is in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. It's really these 12, kind of the first 12 verses of it. And as he's talking about the end, at the beginning he says, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus and our being gathered up together with him, which would be, seems to be a reference to that gathering up of the church. Don't be shaken or alarmed, or either by a spirit or a letter. To the effect of this, let no one deceive you, for that day, that gathering of the church, cannot come unless the rebellion comes first and the man of lawlessness is revealed, or the son of destruction, the son of perdition, maybe another one that your translation may have. And so again, here, the title is not Antichrist, but it does seem to be this figure. But the title that's used is either the man of lawlessness, the son of sin, the son of destruction. And what we see that this person does in verse 4, he opposes and exalts himself against every so-called god or object of worship. So it's not just a rejection of the God of the Bible or the true God. It is a rejection of all the other gods, of all other possible religions, and instead it is him. And then he takes his seat in the temple of God, proclaiming himself to be God. And then, you know, Paul's this funny thing. Don't you remember when I was there and I told you all this stuff? So he's somebody who will come. He objects to all other religions, and in the temple of God, whatever it is that phrase means, which we would probably take literally, is proclaiming that he is God and to be worshipped. And we know at the end, though, the lawless one, the mystery of lawlessness is already at work in 7. The lawless one will be revealed, whom Jesus will kill with the breath of his mouth and bring to nothing by the appearance of his coming. So whenever it is that Jesus comes, the Antichrist will just be killed with Jesus' breath, which is just a beautiful kind of phrase, because what he's trying to do is remind us, hey, yeah, Antichrist sounds really scary. Don't worry, Jesus is just going to kind of breathe, and then just poof, that goes away. Don't have to worry about it. But we see the coming of the lawless one is the activity of Satan with all his power and false signs and wonder and all wicked deceptions of those who are perishing because they refuse to love the truth and be saved. And so the raising up of this man of lawlessness, who I think is the Antichrist here, is part of the active work of Satan, of not just the enemy, of not just demons, but of Satan himself. And it is going to be accompanied with power and with false signs and wonders. So there will be miraculous things, miraculous events, or signs and wonders, some like what Jesus did, but these are false. And so there's a very real sense we'll see kind of repeatedly that the Antichrist is kind of a parody of Jesus. That it's an imitation, but it's a false one. And so he'll try to work miracles too and deceptions. And we see as well in verse 6 that he says, well, and you know what is restraining him now, so that he may be revealed in his time. That verse is a little frustrating to me because the Thessalonians seem to know what's restraining him, but Paul doesn't tell us. He just assumes that we would know what that is. It's certainly God is restraining the Antichrist and keeping him from appearing. So Satan is trying to bring him into the world. He's trying to appear, but he can't yet. Something's holding it back. God is holding it back in some way, but the what is that? Is it just the Spirit of God? Is it just God's power? Most Christians throughout the ages, and you know, it's always hard to get most Christians to agree on anything. Most Christians say the what is the church. That is the church, it is the existence of believers and their presence in the world that is what is currently restraining the Antichrist and keeping him from coming. But the big idea here, so he's going to come, he's going to reject other religions, ask to be worshipped, there will be signs and wonders, be worked by Satan, can't come until Jesus appears, and then when Jesus comes, he dies. Or he will come before Jesus is coming. And there is, but also in 11, God sends a strong delusion that they may believe what is false. So it's even, there's this sense that he's not deceiving people because of his own deceptive power, but that somehow God is enabling people to be deceived. We'll stop there. Next one, in 1 John, John, who, you know, writes the book of Revelation, or at least I believe he wrote the book of Revelation. Maybe you think it was a different John. He doesn't use the word Antichrist in the book of Revelation, but he certainly knows it because he uses it repeatedly in 1 John, and he uses it again in 2 John, starting in chapter 2 and 18. Children, it is the last hour, and you have heard that Antichrist is coming, but so now many Antichrists have come. So there's two things just even in this verse. It does seem to be that John is saying, or at least it's the expectation of the early church, that there is an Antichrist who is going to appear, that there is a singular, real, literal figure who is going to show up. But he says, well, that hasn't happened yet. That's still in the future. But there are many Antichrists here already. And that's how we know that this is the last hour. So there's... And John seems to be, think there's kind of a difference between these things. There are many antichrists, and then there is the antichrist. And so he talks a little more about who these antichrists are. He says, they went out from us, but they were not of us. For if they had been of us, they would have continued with us. But they went out that it might be plain that they are not of us. This seems to be, who are some of these antichrists? They are people who were in the church. They were people who were thought to be believers, who were counted among the fellowship of God, who were worshiping with them, who now are not any longer and seem to be antichrists, which is quite a strong word to use. I wouldn't use that to describe people who have left our church. Probably don't do that, unless you're an apostle. But he says, who is a liar but he who denies Jesus, that Jesus is the Christ, in 22, and this is the Antichrist, the one who denies the Father and the Son. No one who denies the Son has the Father, and whoever confesses the Son has the Father also. And so this really, well, how can he say Antichrist? The way that John uses it and that he defines it is an Antichrist is anyone who denies that Jesus is God. Someone who denies the Trinity, who denies the divinity of Jesus, who denies that Jesus is fully God and fully man, or truly God and truly man, that person is an Antichrist. Which, I mean, just fits linguistically, too, because they are Antichrist. They are opposing Jesus because they are rejecting Jesus. They're rejecting him as the Christ. And so he uses that. But he is tying it in because of how it begins in 18 with the Antichrist who is to come. And he picks it up again. He mentions it in 2 John very briefly in verse 7. He says, many deceivers have gone out into the world, those who do not confess the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh, and such one is a deceiver and the Antichrist. And so again, this seems to not be speaking about the Antichrist, but someone who is an Antichrist, someone who denies that Jesus is God, but also denies that Jesus is going to physically return in the world and that his coming is our blessed hope. And somebody who denies this, they are a liar, they are deceptive, and they are the Antichrist. Or not the Antichrist, an Antichrist. And kind of in both of these passages, in 2 John and in 1 John and 2, part of the warning is, I write these because these people are trying to deceive you, but hold fast to the teachings. So the reason that he warns them of this is so that they will not be deceived by these many antichrists or by the coming antichrist. We then have Matthew 24. This is part of Jesus' Olivet Discourse. This one is somewhat unclear. I think it's a reference to the Antichrist, but you could say that it's not, and it would be, I guess it would be okay. Or I can see how some would reject it. But starting in verse 15, he says, see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel. standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, and those who are in Judea, flee. Then don't, you know, tells them, run away, let your flight not be in the Sabbath. In 21, there will be a tribulation, which has not been, but I'll cut the day short for the sake of the elect. And then in 23, if someone tells you, look, there's Christ, or there he is, don't believe him, for false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders, so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. And then right after that is immediately after the tribulation of those days, the Son will be Son, and then the Son of Man will be coming in the clouds to gather the elect. So what we have happening here, there's a number of things. One, we have the abomination of desolation that is referred to in Daniel. This seems to be referring to Daniel 11 and Daniel 12, which if you're here and you remember when we went through the book of Daniel, the book of Daniel is very complicated too. There's a lot of crazy images, much like in Revelation. There's a lot of different interpretations. There were some of those places where it's like there's 80 different opinions on what this means. But Jesus is referring to one specific part of it being the abomination of desolation. And what we also see before we flip over to Daniel to see what that means, he mentions there are these false Christs who are going to come and false prophets. So this seems to be, at least this part, is not just talking about one figure, but that there are many, and similar to John, that there are going to be many deceptive people who come. But they are also going to have these signs and wonders, and they're going to deceive people. And a warning here is that even the elect will be deceived. Even those who know Jesus, who are believers, seem to have the ability or seem to get caught up and deceived by these antichrists and these false prophets, which should give us pause. It's easy to think about, if we're thinking about a future antichrist coming, and oh yeah, I can't believe the world will fall for this. We should probably pause and think, well, it seems like people in the church will fall for this. It should make us think maybe it's not just the evil person we all hate. Maybe it'll be somebody the church really loves and lots of Christians are excited about. Then we go to Daniel, we flip to Daniel 11 and kind of 12. I'm not going to do all of 11. All of Daniel 11 is talking about the king of the south and the king of the north and these different fighting that they're kind of doing back and forth. But kind of near the end, in 36, talks about the king will do as he wills and will exalt himself and magnify himself above every god and speak astonishing things against the God of gods and shall prosper till the indignation is accomplished and what is decreed shall be done. And again in 37, and he will magnify himself above all. You can see there's some similarities here in the language that's being used to 2 Thessalonians and him exalting himself above all other gods and demanding that he is worshipped. And then it kind of, you know, goes on to some other things that I think relate a little more immediately in the future of Daniel's day. But when he goes on in 11, or in chapter 12, in 11, he says, from that time on, the regular burnt offering is taken away, and the abomination that makes desolate is set up, and there will be 1,290 days. And then back in chapter 11, there it is, in verse 31, he says, forces shall appear, they will profane the temple, take away the burnt offering, and set up the abomination that makes desolate, and then he will exalt himself. And so this appears to be what Jesus is referring to when he's talking about what is going to precede, or what's going to be part of the tribulation that is coming in Jerusalem, and what will precede the coming of Jesus. The king, whoever this figure is, who here is described as the king, takes away the burnt offering, he ruins the temple in some way, and then he demands worship. And he will rule for, the days, it's about 3.5 years, which is a number that will get kind of repeated in other places, especially in Revelation. Now, at least in Daniel 11 and Daniel 12, I do think, I think this is kind of both. I think Daniel 11 and 12 refers to a historical antichrist and the prefiguring the final antichrist, because you can think about, if you remember when we back went through Daniel, it talks about the rise of the Babylonian Empire and the Greek Empire and the Roman Empire and all these different figures. And even especially chapter 10 and 11 describes, you can go through and read some of it with a history book, or 11, and see these different events in history that unfold exactly as God predicted. And there was a Greek king who seemed to have done exactly many of the things that are prophesied here. He profanes the temple, he sacrifices a pig on the altar and demands that people worship him as God and changes his name to be worshipped. Seems like that's part of what Daniel was saying. Now, I don't think where some will say, well, that's it. It's only referring to that. I think he was referring to a historical antichrist that did such things. And it seems like since Jesus quotes it later and says you should expect this to come in the future, that it's going to happen again in another way. That's kind of my opinion on that one. But we also have Daniel 7. This is another place, a nice picture here of the beast, if you want to try and picture what this is. And this is the four beasts that are mentioned in Daniel, which are representing, usually we kind of almost all interpret it as the different empires that take over the world. And the fourth beast arises. So the four great beasts, or the four great kings, arise out of the earth in 717. And I desire to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from the rest and exceedingly terrifying, with teeth of iron, claws, and bronze, which devoured and broke into pieces, stamped what was left with his feet, and there were 10 horns above his head, and the other horn came up, and before three of them fell, and there was a horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke great things and looked greater than its companion. And this horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came. And judgment was given for the saints of the Most High in the time when the saints possessed the kingdom. So even just in there, you can see how there's much of this that seems to be echoing what we'll see in Revelation and echoing parts of what we've seen before, where this is someone who's not just deceiving the saints, but is intentionally attacking the saints, making war against God's people. Especially the horn. And so I think the horn here seems to be referring to the Antichrist particularly. I don't think that this fourth beast necessarily is. And then later we'll see in 25, and the fourth beast, it's the kingdom, but in 25 says, it'll change the times and the law, and they'll be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time, which we typically take that to be 3.5 years, which matches what happens later in Daniel, at the end of Daniel 12. And part of in Revelation. But what will happen to this beast? Well, his kingdom will be taken away from him. In 27, the kingdom, the dominion, the greatness of his kingdoms will be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. And his kingdom, being Jesus' kingdom, will be the everlasting one, and all dominions will serve and obey him. And so at least part of this seems to be referring to the Antichrist. The last real places in Revelation, even though they do not say the word Antichrist, as you see many of these places do not, but they appear to have the connection, is in chapter 13. We have another beast. And so in the beginning, and this beast rises out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads and 10 diadems on the horns and blasphemous names on the head. And on the beast I saw, it was like a leopard, but its feet were like a bear's, its mouth was like a lion's mouth, and to it the dragon gave his power and his authority. But one of the heads seemed to have a mortal wound. Let me pause there for a second. So there's, an attempt to draw what this thing looks like, which is probably a foolish errand to try and describe it. This beast, I think, does appear to be the Antichrist. Although in this chapter, when you read it, it talks about the 42 months, 3.5 years that he exercises authority, blasphemes against God in his dwelling and those who dwell on the earth. He's allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them, and all who are on the earth will worship it. And so a lot of these same things that we've seen in other places are kind of put together in this beast, who I do think is the Antichrist. But at least in this place, there's not a particular mention of the abomination of desolation that is taking place, or anything explicitly about the temple. And it is very similar to the beast in Daniel, but it's described differently. There are horns, there are certainly 10 horns, and the 10 crowns, but it's not a one-to-one. They're not identical. Now, why? You could try and say, well, they're just describing different parts. Maybe they saw exactly the same beast. Daniel just forgot to mention that it has 7 heads, and he just saw the horns and was looking at other parts, and John saw more of it. That could be, I'm not going to say that it's not possible, but I do think I think the beasts are a little different, because I think the horn on the beast in Daniel seems to be the Antichrist, where this entire beast here in Revelation 13 seems to be only referring to the Antichrist, I think. But the dragon gives him authority for 3.5 years. He makes war against the saints, and he conquers. He seems to win, at least temporarily, and then is worshipped by the world. And everyone in the world will worship him, except those whose names were written before the foundation of the world in the book of life. And it does mention that he seems to have a mortal wound, but the mortal wound was healed, and the whole world marveled as they followed the beast and worshipped it and said, "Who is like the beast? Who can fight against it?" This is kind of where you see some of the idea of the Antichrist being a parody of Jesus, or a pale satanic imitation, where Jesus really was mortally wounded and died and defeats death and returns and is resurrected. The Antichrist is mortally wounded, looks like he's going to die, but doesn't, recovers miraculously, seemingly miraculously, and the world marvels and wonders and turns to worship him in a way that they did not turn to worship Jesus and are more impressed by this one. Then we have a second beast, or another beast arises out of the earth, and the second half of chapter 13 and verse 11, it has two horns like a lamb, but it speaks like a dragon. So it looks like a lamb, but it is more similar to a dragon, and it exercises the authority of the first beast in its presence, and it makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose mortal wound was healed, performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven in front of people. And by the signs it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those on the earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded by the sword and lives, and it's allowed to give breath to the image of the beast. So even the image can speak, and causing those who would not worship the beast to be slain, and then causes all, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or forehead, so no one can buy unless they have the mark of the beast, 666. We'll tackle the mark of the beast in 666 later when we get to 13. We'll stay with just this one. So this beast, some try to say, well, maybe it's just describing the Antichrist in a different way. I don't think so. This seems to be describing a prophet. So much in the way that the Antichrist is a parody of Jesus, this beast is kind of a parody of John the Baptist, who is a forerunner and pointed people and led them to worship Jesus. He appears to be a false prophet who is leading people to wrongly worship the beast and calling down fire from heaven. He makes a idol of the beast and then makes it seem to speak and move, and people are amazed and continue to worship it. And this is the beast that leads to the mark. Now, the last place we have in the Bible that talks about the Antichrist is in 19, at the end. When Jesus returns, the rider on the white horse comes, and the beast and the kings of the army in 19 make war against him who was sitting on the horse and his army. But the beast is captured, and with it the false prophet, in whose presence was done the signs, and those who deceived, and they're thrown alive in the lake of fire that burns with sulfur. And the rest were slain by the sword that came from the mouth of him sitting on the horse, and all the birds are gorged with their flesh. They have the big showdown. Jesus returns, and they, both the beast and his prophet, are cast into the lake of fire forever. And then, in the next chapter, in 20, that's when the dragon, the ancient serpent, who is Satan, is bound for 1,000 years. And so it does seem, especially in Revelation, even though it doesn't use the word Antichrist, I think chapter 13 is talking about the Antichrist and his prophet, that it's not Satan, that they're separate figures. That, yes, Satan is using the Antichrist. We can wonder and debate and imagine, well, maybe he possesses this individual or these individuals, like a demonic possession, where this person's uniquely possessed by Satan. Maybe, but they by themselves are cast into hell, and that it is Satan who is individually restrained afterwards. So they do seem to be separate. Now, how have people kind of thought about the Antichrist through history? Very early Christians believed that the beast in Revelation 13 was the Antichrist. Although the beast in Daniel 7 was almost always interpreted as being the Roman Empire, because it's the next empire that came after the empires kind of before it. And so they saw that the beast, at least, is the Roman Empire, but the horns were what they began, especially the little horn in Daniel 7. They would start to think, this seems to be the Antichrist, because it's the horn that's making war, and it's the horn that's asking to be worshipped. There was this then growing belief that started to appear kind of early by the 4th century that the Antichrist was going to be a Jew from the tribe of Dan. Maybe you have heard that before. You may wonder, where does that come from? Well, we guess, but the places that it comes from is one in Revelation 7 when it talks about the 144,000 who are sealed from the tribes. The tribe of Dan is not mentioned. And so people wonder, maybe that's why, because the Antichrist came from there. Then the other place they take it from is in Genesis 49:17 when Jacob is blessing all of his sons. And for Dan, he says, Dan will be a serpent in the way and a viper of the path who bites the horse's heels and the rider falls backward. And so there's the imagery of the viper and the serpent. And so they kind of take it that way. It's the best guess that you're going to get. It's not explicit. I don't think we can just take it and say, that's obviously true. But that's kind of where that started to come from. Roman emperors were identified as the Antichrist, especially Nero. And the very early church was called that, or at least they were seen as the horns, because the beast has 10 horns, and so they'd kind of take, maybe this is 10 antichrists, or we'll have 9 kind of little antichrists, and then we'll get the final one. So every terrible Roman Empire or emperor that they got who oppressed the church was kind of identified as an antichrist. Now by the 4th century, once the Roman Empire has become Christian and now we love the Roman Empire, they started to move away from thinking the fourth beast was the Roman Empire and their emperors are antichrists and just took it. Maybe it's just the false teaching, especially the way John talks about antichrists. There are those who deny Jesus thought, that must have the same thing. It just kind of means that throughout it. And that kind of stayed that way until the 11th century. Somebody raised the idea, you know what, when it talks about him worshiping or coming to the temple of God and demanding to be worshiped in 2 Thessalonians, maybe that's just not talking, that's not talking about the Jewish temple, that's talking about the temple of the church. And, who's asking for worship there? Maybe a pope, not the pope now, but a pope in the future could be seen as the Antichrist. And so as the Roman church continued to get more and more corrupt, that idea blossomed, and especially the reformers who didn't love Revelation, but they loved this idea a lot. And so they all affirmed almost unanimously. The reformers couldn't agree on a lot of stuff other than that they hated the Roman Catholic Church, but they all agreed the papacy is the Antichrist. But their distinction there was it wasn't the pope, it was the station, the office, the idea of the pope itself. That is Antichrist, because he is in the temple of God and he's misleading, he's deceived the elect, and he's leading people into false worship. And so that's where you get lots of people, why do people say the pope's the Antichrist? Well, just go back to the 11th century, but especially the Reformation. That just got repeated a lot. And then today, you'll usually see kind of any kind of political leader who gets a lot of following that people don't like will say, they must be an Antichrist, or that maybe they will be the Antichrist. And so, especially with the 666, because you can make those numbers do anything you want and turn it in any name you want if you have enough creativity and time. And so that kind of ends up being what's happening. Now, how we kind of put this stuff together. Now, there are some who will try and object and say, I really don't think that we need to expect a literal Antichrist in the future. Even if they do want to say that, they need to acknowledge the fact that there are many literal Antichrists now, present. Seems to be what John said. People still deny the divinity of Jesus. There's still people who deny the coming of Jesus in the flesh. So I do think, takeaway is there's many more antichrists running around in the world today than we imagine. When we think about antichrist, we're thinking about, the Left Behind or Nikolai Carpathia, or we're thinking of the big bad person who it's going to be. When probably the first thing we should think of is the many antichrists among us who deny Jesus and who even were a part of us but have gone out. Now, there is still a singular Antichrist figure who is coming, and all of the Antichrists in our day and in the days and in the past as well have been pointing towards this one. And so part of this This is just speculation, so I can't claim that this is 100% what the Bible teaches. But I do think that it makes sense to me, at least, that Satan would be continually preparing Antichrist to come, because nobody knows when Jesus will return. No one knows when the tribulation will begin. If Jesus doesn't know, Satan certainly doesn't know. And so that it makes sense to me that he would continually be trying to raise figures and prepare people to get ready to make war against the saints. Whoever this Antichrist is, they will kill and temporarily triumph over the church before dying. So that's kind of the big picture ideas, I think, that we do have. But my applicational thoughts, what do we do with all of this instead of just learning interesting information about the Antichrist, is one, we should probably spend much more time worrying about the Antichrist among us today than we worry about the Antichrist who may be coming tomorrow. Because we know there are those, and I don't mean political figures or, you know, don't try and guess. I'm not telling you, hey, I think Satan's doing this. Don't try and guess who those people are. Stop that. But there are certainly many who deny Jesus, and those are the ones we should probably be more focused on. And we certainly should spend a lot more time looking to Jesus than we are looking at Antichrist or the Antichrist or Antichrists in general. I think we should all be on the same page there. Though it's worth studying, great. Don't spend all your time here forever. That would be a problem if you spent all your time studying the Antichrist and forgot to look at the Christ who we're supposed to be worshiping. Okay, that is a brief overview of what the Bible seems to teach about the Antichrist, or at least all the different places, all the different passages. So you're welcome to go study all those passages more on your own and kind of dig a little deeper. Any questions? Anything I can clarify? Maybe here. Is that a question, Quinn? Just an objection? Okay. Well, let me pray for us. You have a question, you pull me aside afterwards. Lord, I just thank you that you are so wonderful and you are so incredible and amazing and powerful that the enemy can only attempt to imitate you, and he does a poor job. And that all of the power and the might that the Antichrist has is only something that you allow. Can only appear when you stop restraining him. He can only deceive when you allow it. It can only work whatever miracles you give him the power to do. Lord, it is not that the Antichrist is an encouraging figure to study or to think about, but I am encouraged when I think and realize and study your word to see what a horrible time period this will be. Know that you are still in charge even then. It's not something that will be a surprise to you. It's something that you have already seen and that you are in control of. God, I pray that as we go throughout our days and as we, you know, go from this place, Lord, would you help us to leave with confidence and confidence and faith in you and your power and your ability and what you will do, and especially that we would be looking forward to the return of Christ and the return of Jesus, who will wipe every tear from every eye and who will defeat every enemy. Would you help us to keep our eyes fixed on you and not be distracted by other things? We pray this in the name of Jesus. Amen. All right. Thanks for being here tonight.